rights and then benefits to actually have to work for a living or to toil in order to get their daily bread. That was in Pesach Design, verse 17 on page 18 and 19. And now we're up to verse 18, which is Pesach Ches, the next Pesach. And in that Pesach it says, the cooks of the Dalgaris are Kmiach Loh. The translates here, thorns and thistles shall sprout for you. The house of Eitzavah, so then you shall eat the herb of the field. So there's some of that in the Mishnah. Dargar means an artichoke. I don't know. Does everybody know what an artichoke is?
Yeah.
Artichoke.
It's like a vegetable, yeah. But like a, it looks like a leaf.
So you make guacamole?
It looks like a cactus.
No,
it's like
an avocado.
Oh.
No.
Artichoke. Yeah, the bottom of the plant.
Yeah.
Like, you peel off the leaf.
So I don't know exactly how artichokes would fit into this process. It doesn't sound like artichokes are particularly bad things to grow, but in any event, that's what it means in the Mishnah here. Therefore, it's translated not that way. Here, it's translated as a thistle. I'm not sure the difference between a thorn and a thistle is, though. I think they're both pokey and sharp and hurt. But I don't know if that, what?
$4.
I don't think any of the thorn either.
Huh?
They're sharp plants. If you eat them, they'll be back on the insult. Anyway, The way the Malbim explains it here, the Malbim says that why are the thorns and thistles getting mixed in with the grain? Because just like Adam caused good and bad to be mixed together, right? Because now within him there are inclinations towards good and towards bad. So too the symbolism here is that he has within the land both the good stuff and the bad stuff, right? He has stuff which is good, which is the good grain, which we talked about in the previous process, which grows together with the thorns and thistles of this process. Similarly, now I want to say that even at the end of our says, well, how does Esau have so bad? When you eat the grain of the land, the herb of the field, that also says that obviously herbs, when you harvest them, have a lot of mud and dirt attached to them. So the process of growing stuff now is going to actually involve lots of dirt and lots of thorns. It's very different from the Garden of Eden, because the Garden of Eden, they only ate, it seems, from trees. And trees don't grow on the ground, right? I mean, they grow, right? The fruit does not grow on the ground. You pluck the fruit off the tree, and it is clean. It doesn't have to be sorted. It doesn't have to be fresh. Everything is wonderful just to pick up the fruit. In fact, the Medrash says, I don't have to be taken literally, but let's assume that it is for the moment. The Medrash says that in Gan Eden and eventually in the world to come, trees will produce loaves of bread. We don't just need to harvest grain and go through the order of making bread, but rather bread will grow on trees. I know many of us prefer money grow on trees, but the idea is that you in Gan Eden, well, if you take it literally or figuratively, in Gan Eden, they didn't have to work in order to produce the bread. They just plucked the bread, so to speak, off the tree. But now, as I said, a tree is off the ground and clean and very respectable. But now, everything is going to go down into the dirt. It's going to have to toil with the dirt and with the thorns and get all the muddy and, full of cuts and all that kind of stuff because good and bad are no longer separate. The fruit is not off the ground, but rather everything's in the ground. So the man says at this point, Adam started crying. He broke down. Why did he break down? Because he said, you know what? That means I'm exactly like the animals. Because animals eat grasses, and I eat grasses, right? Animals go out and they take the grain from among the thorns and the thistles, and I take the grain from among the thorns and the thistles. So what's the difference between me and the animals? He was very depressed about this. Until Hashem told him the next pasuk. Next pasuk made him feel better. Next pasuk says, "V'se'at tapecho tocho lechem. By the sweat of your brow you shall eat bread." So when he was happy, he said, oh, at least there's this difference. I get to eat bread. Hashem didn't give animals bread. They don't bake bread. But I get to bake bread. In some way, I'm still higher than the animals are. So that in of itself, is, even though it was a curse, you were told by the slave, you're glad to eat bread. But nevertheless, it still separates them, differentiates them from the animals. Yeah.
So the bread made them feel better.
The bread made them feel better, right.
So like, you could say the bread was kind of like the first Prozac?
Yesterday it was psychoanalysis, today it's psychiatry. Yeah. The, it's an interesting thing, though, once you mentioned that Frodo Kaplan said, I don't think he's made some of these material from the Zohar, sort of as I mentioned many times, is a great Hasidic Rebbe of the 1800s, he died in 1900, probably one of the greatest Jewish thinkers of all time. And he writes that, really, medicine should not be necessary, because food itself should have all the nutrients and all the medicinal properties which one should need in order to sustain oneself. The reason why medicines became necessary is because people started becoming sick. When did people start becoming sick? After they vanished from the Garden of Eden. In fact, there's some evidence from Chazal that sickness didn't even occur until much later. It says that when they start getting sick, you remember when the
medicine comes? Yaakov's horse. What? Yaakov's
horse,
isn't it?
Yaakov's horse. Yaakov's horse, right? It says that until the days of Yaakov, people used to cough and drop dead. There was no way to, people would not survive that first cough. So Yaakov Avinu was the one, according to the medrash, who was Mechadesh, he brought into this novel idea of dying of illness, you know, over time and not just abruptly. So I don't know if it's taken literally that there was no illness to learn or it's a figurative thing. A lot of things in the we know figurative. But the point is that really bread should have all the necessary nutrients for an individual to lead a healthy life in which all sickness is prevented, right? And the Zohar, in fact, calls matzah, which we eat the night of Pesach, mechlo dasvoto, the bread of healing. And the Sura says, it's kipshuto, it's to be taken literally. It means that the whole idea of matzah represents man before the sin, because the sin is represented, obviously, by chametz, by the leavening, right, by the leavening effect. So therefore, man before the sin is represented by the matzah. And before the sin, food would have the healing quality of not just giving spiritual sustenance, but also physically sustaining and keeping a person well. And matzah, even today, he says, has this vestige of being a healthy type of food, is that if you eat matzah with the right intention, so matzah really can kind of give you some, I don't know exactly how it makes you healthy, but it can make you, give you even physical health as a result. Yeah.
When I was in Israel, I heard, I kind of recap on what it was. I heard some kind of story which connects matzah as well to the resurrection, to the thing of Jesus.
Right, so
That was his last supper.
You know, there were no
satyrs
now.
Right, I was trying to remember. I couldn't remember.
What
kind of institution
were you in?
No. I met a lot of people. People always used to come up to me and she used to give me a book for free and try and share with their best friends and, you know, oh, you should do this and Jesus this.
Was
there no place like this? It was before I went to the Shiva,
Something else is that maybe this is what they're referring to is that in the Christian doctrine of transubstantiation, which means that when you partake in a communion, then you are eating a wafer and drinking wine, and the wafer becomes the body of Yahshua, it actually becomes his body in your mouth.
Yeah, that's
and the wine becomes his blood.
This is what it was.
Right. So that wafer is matzah. I'm not sure, I don't think they're makti that should become chametz, but that wafer is symbolic of matzah.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. That's what I heard.
Yeah, so the,
Jesus made of matzah. Jesus made of matzah.
From the tree. I don't know if it's literally bread. I don't know if there were white bread trees and rye bread trees and pumpernickel trees.
I don't know.
But, you know, there was, like, there was whatever sustenance they needed in a tasty, fully edible way they could take off a tree. Okay? So I don't know if it's literally, it's the Gemara actually says, I think it's a Gemara Tanedin, as Pido Eretz Yisrael, the 11th century Eretz Yisrael will produce, the trees will produce, ruskos, bake, fully baked loaves of bread, and clay melas, fully formed clothing, silk clothing. So I imagine there's going to be, you know, the regular tree, the portly tree, everybody's going to get their own tree to get their own clothing from the sailor clothing. So
it's
then,
so hard to find a portly tree.
So the idea is that, of course, everybody in the world to come will be on a level where they don't have to work again, right? Things will be prepared because leisure time will not become a big negative, right? People will be prepared to use their leisure time the right way. So in the meantime, it's not that way. In the meantime, you do eat bread, and that's why the bracha we make is hamotzi lechem min haaretz, right? We say God brings forth bread from the ground. Anybody remember the thing about that ever? That very funny bracha where we make hamotzi. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz, God takes bread out of the ground. Hogwash! God doesn't take bread out of the ground. I took the grain out of the ground and I take the bread.
From the ground, no?
And therefore what?
Hamotzi, you find the bread. From the ground.
You find the bread from the ground? Hamotei means you found the bread. I'm not sure how that would make you happier, but okay. That would mean that he found the bread, but Hamotei means he brings that.
Brings out.
So there are two meanings of this. One is, and they're both intended, one is that it alludes to the time when in the past and the time in the future when bread will grow on trees out of the ground. And the other is that it alludes to the fact that Hashem designed the earth not that we should eat the raw grain, which of course others felt to be a terrible thing because it makes them equivalent to the animals, but rather we should eat it in the form of bread. Yeah.
I was wondering, how did, like, how do people find out how to make bread? I mean, you have like wheat in the field, you can't eat it, it doesn't taste good, like you chew it and like, but then someone decides that, oh, if you cut it all down and you throw it in the air and you separate this and you mix it with this and with water and you bake it and in the oven for this amount and it'll rise and you let the dough rise. And I was just amazed that anyone would ever figure that out, that like just from like, you know,
like
grass that you see outside, you make like a nice loaf of bread, it tastes good.
You're right, it's a big thing. But I've always remembered that there's a certain Japanese delicacy which is made of poisonous fish. Right?
Fugu.
Fugu, is that what it's called? I always wondered, you know, how did they figure out how to eat it? You know, how many people died before they actually figured out how to eat fugu? And, you know, the trial and error was involved in that. It's a fascinating concept, you know. Like they say that occasionally people still drop dead in restaurants because it was prepared the wrong way.
You can get it in New York. So that place in America, you can get it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Is it worth trying?
I've never tasted it. Maybe it is.
Delicacy.
What a way to go.
Kosher?
So they...
I don't know if it's worth trying. Kosher is spicy fish in Florida. I don't know if they have fish in
Florida. Yeah, maybe they're
not. Spice. They blow up. They puff up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's
horrible.
Okay, I really don't know. So I don't suggest eating it, even if it is kosher. So here the Malvin says, again, the idea is that bread has to be brought about through a process of cleansing and refining. Like, first you have to remove the chaff from the kernels, and then you have to grind the kernels and make sure to sift it, and then you have to actually, you know, combine it with water. There's so many processes which occur in the making of bread, and of course, one of the ways in which we know the malachos which are forbidden on Shabbat, the things which are prohibited to do on Shabbat, is we're not allowed to do things which are involved in baking bread. So, sidura de pat, the things which are required to make bread, all the way from the planting to the actual baking. So all those things are forbidden to do on Shabbat because that's considered the constructive activity which man was given after the sin in order to be able to keep him occupied with making his bed. It's interesting, you know, I don't see that anybody speaks about this specifically here. I mean, I don't see the Mormons speak about it, I don't see the article either. But it's interesting that the pasuk stresses by the sweat of your brow. Zeas hapecha, right? So the question is, what exactly, you know, really, apecha doesn't mean your brow. Your brow, I think, is here, your forehead, right? Is that in English, the word brow? Like eyebrow.
Yeah, brow. It's up here. Yeah.
But ass in Hebrew is a nose. Right? So what is... What? That's what it says. By the sweat of your nose. So I'm not sure exactly how it came to be the sweat of your brow.
It dribbles down your nose.
It dribbles off your nose.
It dribbles off your brow, too.
It's really smooth. But the sweat actually comes from your hair, mostly. It doesn't come from mostly from... Where does sweat develop?
It comes out of your face. It comes all over your face.
It comes out of your face? Yeah,
there's
a lot of
force. It's on your brow and on your nose.
Mm-hmm.
Like you really sweat.
Uh-huh. So in any case, I don't know why they translate as brow, but the ass is an interesting that anger in Torah is always associated, or very often associated, with the nose. Haron ass. It says, when somebody gets angry, it says, Ba'yichai ah. And then remember, we had the code last week, Pasha, Hashem, from Moshe, that we're angry at Paro, 2 Pashas ago. Ba'yichai ah, Moshe. So, the Haron ah is the term for anger, right? So, anger, I think it's called this term for anger because it means that when you get angry, your nostrils start getting wider. So that means that your nostrils flare when you get angry. So the but I'm trying to explain why it's specifically in terms of anger. So it could be I'm wrong. But anyway, the idea that is associated with anger seems to mean that man is giving sweat in order to work off his anger. Meaning that man has been given the capacity to sweat in other ways to kind of channel the heat which he feels, which he's going, and the truth is, we don't see anger till now anywhere in Chumash. Doesn't seem to have arisen till now, but we saw it.
Excuse
me?
We don't see dinosaurs for that
matter. True, but we also see anger later on. Anger is going to come up relatively soon in terms of Cain and Hevel, right? Right, Cain and Hevel, Cain gets angry at Hevel and kills him, right? So what God is doing here is preparing, he's suggesting, listen guys, till now, the main sin that you've sinned has been desire, lust. Guess what? There are more coming. And one of the sins which is coming is anger, right? This is a new trait which you might suffer from in your next condition, which is going to be strife and competition. So therefore, let me tell you that a good way to dissipate anger is to sweat off your anger by working. And the interesting thing is also that we know that Zeus has to do with heat, of course, and the way a person gets worked up in when a person works or does anything of which gets him heated up, actually a person can diminish the affliction which he will feel in Gehenna, which is likened to a fire, by getting all worked up in this world. Now, of course, it doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, every time you sin, in order to start doing tshuva, you can go and get yourself worked up, like work up a sweat, and you're going to atone for your sin. But the idea is that if a person is able to reflect his angry or, you know, his kind of violent tendency into some positive channel, so then actually that is the way in which he avoids having to burn in Ganon. Because instead of you taking out violence on other people or other entities on which he should not take it out, he's taking it out in his work, working up the sweat and getting taking out his anger and his violence in that way.
Same thing for the cold
Gehenna,
right? You have to roll in the snow.
Right, for the cold Gehenna, you have to roll in the snow, right? What?
It doesn't make sense to carry that in physical terms. It's not a physical thing. It's not the cold Gehenna, the hot Gehenna. What is it?
What else are we supposed to relate to it as? In other words, you have no other way of experiencing pain other than the physical corroborating
it.
That's
not true. Loneliness itself is an example of pain. Emotional pain
is pain, but it's, you know, there's pain and there's pain, right? So when you put when you feel embarrassed or ashamed, that's painful. But when you put your finger on a hot stove and keep it there, that's very, very, very painful. So there's pain in the pain. We want to emphasize that You know, the pain of being ashamed there is like the pain you feel by putting your finger on a stove here.
I think that's you're on a higher spiritual level. That's what. No, I get that.
Yeah.
I think that's true, but we feel the physicality much more than the spirituality. Therefore, it's much more important for us to understand the physical
pain.
Even though it is true that spiritual pain is much more painful than physical pain, but we do not feel it. So it's important to talk about it.
And even if we do feel it, even if we do feel emotional pain, it's hard to say, when, like, when you are really sad after a tragedy, it's much different than if someone tells you, oh, well, you're going to be sad like if this tragedy happens, because we're not feeling that right now. Whereas if you say, it's going to be like if you put your hand on a stove, and we know what that feels like, yeah, like we can put our hand on a stove.
You know, there's a very, I read something really, really good a while ago. It was a book, and it was about pain itself. Now, basically, when you're a young child, a young child falls over and he cuts himself. The child will not cry until he actually sees the damage that body's done. And then you're not going to feel. People say that you don't feel pain until you look at the pain and see what it is.
Really?
Think about it. When you're a child and you fell over and you cut all your leg open, and you get up and you carry on running, and suddenly your friend will point to your knee and you'll go, "What have you done to your knee?" And you look down. And that's when you'll feel the pain. You see the blood and you see the fire,
but if something happens to you, you'll feel it. No, didn't do it.
Who was it?
A friend of mine got shot in his mind.
And you feel it?
He ran like three blocks to a
7-Eleven.
He heard the gun go
off. He didn't feel it. If I got shot in
the left, we're
about to get a
slippy right away. He didn't feel it until someone pointed out that it was like, that's the
okay, and anyway, I think that's the idea. The physical pain really is what brings things home to us. By the way, another way in which, the more effective way in which one can handle one's anger, if at all possible, the Chazal say, is by Rizkor D'Oraita. All anger is bad, except for the anger which one displays in learning. Meaning, if you start shouting at your chavrutim, throwing chairs at him in the base medrash, don't hurt him. That's considered to be a positive, a positive.
Realized.
Right?
Like a positive experience. Would you like to share part because next week we're going to get reported to that chair?
Yes, don't take any chairs, please. Don't throw any chairs. But I just don't throw them. So the the idea is that when you get excited in learning Torah, so then that also causes the person to become heated up, and that's heating a person to so that's usually that anger doesn't lead to violence and blows. Just to make sure it doesn't. So, but that anger is arouses the person, a sort of passion, which also channels one's anger in a positive direction. Okay? pain is pain we could be brought up as a kind of a peripheral, tangential thing that, the pain of Gehenna is likened to fire, right? Yes. But now we're talking about anger itself, right? Yes. And anger is a tendency of a human being has a need to become aroused, right? It's part of the human psyche. The person has become aroused and passionate about things, right? So the problem is that anger is a very, very bad trait to have. The Rambam says all traits except for two, you can use in a positive way. But anger and pride are traits that you have to avoid altogether. So the question is, that is the case, though. So what about the human tendency to get angry, right? So how do you, so to speak, deal with that? So one way is to go work it up. Go work in the field and get angry at your plow. But the other way to do it is to go and use your anger to positively channel that emotion, sublimate it, meaning use it not for the purpose of getting angry at another human being, but for the arousal which you can experience in the course of learning and, being extremely excited about what you're doing. I once heard from a great Talmud Chacham, he said, he only meant this half seriously. It says, as the Gemara was said in the dark, it says that the Yerushalayim was destroyed because they judge judgment according to the Torah. So the Gemara says, so the Gemara then itself asks, you know, what are you talking about? If they judge according to the Torah, it should be perfectly fine. Why should Yerushalayim be destroyed because of that? And then the Gemara goes on to discuss, well, maybe it's something else. But he said like this, this name was Rabat, he just died a few weeks ago from Detroit. He said that in Yerushalayim at the time, when the Beit HaMikdash was being destroyed, so people were robbing and cheating and competing with each other and all sorts of, you know, underhanded and very highly competitive and devious way when it came to making a buck. When it came to being to learning Torah, everybody was polite, sedate, and nice, and they just, you know, well, everything did exactly everything according to what they felt was the proper halacha. So he said, what do they value more? Obviously, they valued more the riches which they could acquire, because for that they were mice and nefesh. They gave themselves over with robbing, with cheating, with stealing, all that kind of stuff. If they would have shown that type of enthusiasm when they were learning, so that would have shown up that they appreciate her as much as they appreciate other things. But on the contrary, the fact that they're willing to be calm and sedate when they learn, that means that they were actually not feeling any excitement over that. They only got their excitement in other places.
Compare that to nowadays, really, can't we?
What?
And compare that to nowadays as well, really.
How so? Go ahead.
Most people don't particularly... most people learn. No, most people don't learn. They want to do something exciting, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or
surfing.
Video games.
People put a lot more energy into other things, like you.
I understand that, so maybe everybody's different.
Yeah, people,
right?
It depends. I mean,
no, I agree. He's not so great. Right? Agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Just try to supply it.
My final agreement then.
Right. Okay.
But I can say that, yeah, obviously, it depends on which time. I mean, I had a lot from birth, FFBs, that are a lot, I can't say that.
That's the problem which FFBs have, and that many of them have, for many of them, by the time they reach whatever age
they want to experience more of the non.
Yeah, Torah is very monotonous. They're looking for something much more exciting because they were taught it from a young age and were not taught in an exciting way. They were taught it by rote and to by drill.
Exactly, yeah.
So therefore, they don't find any excitement in Torah. So where they find their excitement, they'll find their excitement in other ways. Mm. Right.
Well, I
want to
understand a little stronger. Some people, I know, when they get angry, they hit, you know, it's physical or thing they often hit, which is certainly very, very bad. In other words, it's a criminal act. I don't understand how, why they do that, frankly. I don't understand when you get angry, you, some people hit others,
Well, there are different people of different natures, and different societies accept different things. But the truth is, let's take that example, right? Some people have tendencies to become violent when they get angry, right? So what we would say to such a person probably is, you know what? Instead of hitting somebody else, go buy yourself a punching bag, and every time you get angry, start punching the punching bag, right? Don't punch anybody else. And we actually have... What?
Yeah.
Gradually, your anger will dissipate as a result. But what the problem is,
I don't want to hit a punching bag, though.
Well, that's true. Okay, the punching, however, is suggesting that there are other ways also in order to, you know, to channel your anger, to channel that type of tendency which you have, which is to work up sweat in other ways.
Yeah,
is that satisfying? It's not as satisfying, perhaps, as punching the other guy out. But nevertheless, it's a way in which the anger can be dissipated.
Well, become a cop, and then you can
right.
Maybe Abe's question could be answered by saying that heated argument is a substitute for the expression of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. That's a good way to put it. Okay. Very good. So the did you have a comment on maybe before you did have something? I think you had your hand up before.
There was arguing. The idea of arguing, heated arguing. And it being a good thing to have heated arguments. Does that mean that when you're studying in the Beit HaMikdash, that people who are studying together should be looking for points of contention, should create a sort of a should play devil's advocate in order to get a good argument, or should arguments be limited to those that truly reflect their theory?
Well, that's an interesting question, because there are people who will pick a fight in learning, even though there's really nothing to pick a fight about, and that's just annoying. But but in fact, yes, one is supposed to look for points to argue about, points to deliberate, to deliberate, to debate, and to start arguing about, because that's the way things become clarified by argumentation and argumentation and clarification. The Gemara says.
Yeah, I'm sort of
talking about
that.
So you like debating? Yeah, like debating. Well, debating is it's not. Yeah, but debating people to debate a point for the sake of debate. We don't go that far, right? You don't debate for the sake of debate. There has to be some sort of real intent to get something accomplished, not just to have fun debating each other and honing one's skills. But the Gemara talks about a pasuk in Chukas. Yeah, it says that there's a funny part, it's not a funny part, but it's a part which is related from some sort of epic poem, the snippet of some epic poem which we don't have. So it says, Kaini Amir, therefore it was said, B'Sefer Milchamas Hashem, in the book of the words of God, which again, it's not good that we have this book, Et Vahed B'Tzufah, it speaks about, with a little translation here, the gift of the sea of reeds, that and Chalim are known, and the rivers of are known, and the Rashi there and the commentators say that there was, in our known, there was a certain miracle occurred, and the Jews got a lot of loot out of that miracle, just like they did by the splitting of the sea. But the rabbis also take this book in an allegorical sense, not literally, an allegorical sense. And they say, it says, Al-Kaydi Omer Mesekir Mechonot Hashem, if something is stated in a book and people war about it, meaning they go to war in the Beit Medrash, arguing back and forth about an issue, the Esvahed B'Sufah, they will come to love each other in the end. That's for hey, literally from the language of Ahava. So it means that if you really are arguing with your chavrusa for the right reasons, then you're not going to come, unlike in a violent argument about bad things, not going to come eventually to detest and hate that person, but rather you're going to come to love him because together the two of you are seeking and accomplishing a deeper understanding of things. Yeah. Right, Machlokes Shem Shemayim certainly is kind. Right, now Machlokes Shem Shemayim. Yeah.
That was just described as four findings, but it's on a higher level, it brings about good. There are people that lost the find four. And I was working at one time with a person in Europe. He used to get looted on roll over. And if you walked past him in his room, if you looked miserable, rolled over the design, it means that the design was good. If you look at it, it's a better body. That means it would never work. So there's some people that find faults and are just interpret and get angry and
Yeah, okay, but we're not saying it's finding faults. It's not what they mean. That's the person who's like a pessimistic outlook on things and tries to look at things in a negative way. Mm-hmm. We're talking about people who are pursuing, not finding faults so much as trying to clarify through argumentation.
Yes.
It's interesting that in terms of the story of the Eden, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, said that one of the great, one of the great Sfarim in the Yeshiva was called the Shev Shmaitzel. That's nice. And this book about all sorts of issues and topics in Gemara and in Halacha. We said, why is this such a great book? Why is this a book of enduring popularity in the Yeshiva world? It's not because of what he says, so much as that you can argue on everything he says. Meaning that the book brings as it serves not as to tell us what's true, that wouldn't make it necessarily a book of lasting value, but the fact that the questions the book asks can stimulate so much, you know, think thought, and you're able to argue with his conclusions and come up with your own new conclusions, that's a unique quality which makes the sefer have enduring value and popularity. So actually, in Judaism, but Noah Weinberg says this on one of the tapes, he says in Judaism, the question is more valued than the answer. Because, you know, answers are dime a dozen, but to come up with a really good question, that's something which is, you know, much more difficult to do. And that's why, like I said, we keep Adrian on the Gemara, you know, we always ask lots of questions, and read them difficult. So that's really the greatness of Rabbi Akiva Eger, that he couldn't find answers for his questions because they were so good. So that's the idea of trying to build argumentation and trying to find out more and more answers based on things we learn. Yeah.
Bringing this back to where we started, by the study of your brow,
yeah.
If I can change the
title.
We begin understanding in the Zion reading that this was into the pastoral life.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering if there's a connection and we can understand, bridge the gap between when you sort
very
of
see
God and then the reading. Something
I didn't
know.
I say that the food, I would have to think about it, but it's a good direction. The nostrils, Baita Sapa of Nishmat Chaim, through the nose, man receives life, and exhaling through the nose in a very negative way, that's considered the anger. Mm-hmm. There certainly must be some connection there. Yeah. Okay, very good. That's fair. Okay, so today we spoke about work, tomorrow we'll speak about that. All right.